Hello and welcome back to Unite Plan. It's been a while, hasn't it, Paul?
Just a bit.
We had a little break, you know, everyone's busy with washing the cooking and stuff. So, but after a bit of a break for a few months, we're back, and this is our first kind of proper talk we've done for a while. And what better guest to have to welcome back in the Kitchen Revelation but Andrew Johnson.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for inviting me back. I'm glad you've been able to sort of get things coordinated again to do another recording, so that's great. Thanks for inviting me.
Very good. Thank you. And it's been a while. Welcome back, Andrew. Back into the Kitchen of Revelation. Still as familiar as ever?
Well, indeed. you know, it's almost like deja vu, I suppose, but, you know, there's such a lot been happening. But I've been trying to take a bit of a back seat and just... you know, like I've been away a couple of times and I've had my own university work to get on with and stuff and had a sort of bit of a change in domestic circumstances for good reasons. So, you know, but I've still been trying to keep up with various things that get posted, but also not get too drawn into the various scenarios to the point where, you know, I just get depressed with things, you know, and trying to sort of, whilst observing things, at least, you know, have some sort of detachment and look at why certain things are being, you know, given attention.
Yeah.
And that includes both from the, you know, the mainstream side or the shamestream side, as I generally now call it, and from the alternative side.
Yes. Yeah.
Because both sides, as we know, kind of have different narratives that they work to. And we hope that... the stuff that we get into is the more truthful narratives, but nevertheless, you know, some people make claims beyond what the evidence actually supports.
Yes, and this, or ignore it.
Or they ignore it, indeed. Yeah. And this applies to most of the topics that you and I have talked about. You know, you have talked about the other guests, COVID being one, 9/11 being one, and, you know, all the stuff that's come out since we last spoke about the situation in the Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so even with that one, for example, I didn't want to get drawn into the Ukraine sort of narrative, partly because I suppose I'd got a bit fed up of all these scenarios being presented to us and essentially forced in front of us. And for example, to see... in fact, a chap sent me a picture taken from his back garden, one of my readers from the Evidence website, and from his back garden he could see two Ukraine flags in adjoining gardens, you know, just the sort of top flagpoles and that, you know, and I'm thinking, so people have gone straight out of the COVID narrative, which have kind of dropped off considerably. It's still, of course, there, but the restrictions and so forth that were in place have all but disappeared, certainly domestically in the UK they have. It's not quite the same as some other countries, as we know. And then they just go straight into this Ukraine narrative, you know. And for people that have not researched this, probably many of your viewers will have researched it probably more than I have.
Yeah.
The first thing that I was made aware of was that the president of the Ukraine, Zelensky, I forget which is his name, who's now president of Ukraine, in 2015, and you probably heard this, he was in a TV series as an actor playing the president of the Ukraine. You know,
You could make it up, but
yeah.
You don't have to.
You know, and then you find out that he has all these connections to these billionaires and stuff, you know. So we got to being an actor, and, you know, this is never spoken of in the mainstream. And then you get into all this discussion of whether a lot of the footage from the Ukraine has been staged in one way. But then, you know, you ask yourself, and I haven't really studied this, many viewers will perhaps post comments on this video when you publish it. Is this a narrative to demonise Russia? And then people have said, oh, well, Putin is really a good guy. You know, he's working with the QAnon group to, you know, fight the globalists, you know, and all of this. And you know, and you can make an argument that might be true. And Putin certainly has said some strange things. And I remember watching a video about him talking about the misrepresentation of Russia in the Western press, and most of it to me made sense. But then at the same time, you can find pictures of Putin with Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum, you know, from 4 or 5 years ago, shaking hands with the guy. So what? How does that factor in? Because, of course, WEF, which has been driving a large part of the COVID narrative, those members, and that was pretty well established. So again, you know, you seem to go from group to group when you look at who's causing all this, you know, this enslavement of humanity. You know, I hadn't heard of the World Economic Forum 4 years ago. I knew about the meetings at Davos.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But 4 or 5 years ago, more people were talking about the Bilderberger Group. And hardly anybody talks about them now. People talk about the Zionists, you know, instigating all these plots. And maybe the Zionists are behind all the thrust for a digital currency, you know. And then we'll say, well, it's all the Freemasons, you know, and I've said this before. So you get all the fingers pointed at these various groups. And I always wonder, I don't disagree that, for example, it's clear that the World Economic Forum have got a huge stake in the COVID narrative and what they're trying to force into society from that.
You can see the agendas lining up
with it. Yeah,
yes.
And you can clearly see on their website, for example, the other thing which has been very much present on our minds, or been forced onto us by the shame stream, is the climate change again. Yeah. That they've now given that another reboot because of all the hot weather we've had in the UK. You know, we're all going to die and all our houses are going to burn down because we're reaching 37 degrees rather than 30 degrees. You know, and of course they blithely disregard the fact that it's regularly 40 degrees centigrade in the summer in places like Turkey and Portugal,
of course,
and they manage to survive with few, if any, problems. Yes, they might have a siesta in the afternoon, but I think that's about it, you know, and they certainly have less water to play with than we do in most of those countries. So really, again, the mainstream media is creating problems for us to be fearful of, by and large, and that appears to be their job. And that hasn't changed. It's just the narratives which change and the emphasis on particular parts of those narratives which change. And, you know, so... and I think you can then, as I've said before, and I was saying earlier, you can fall into this trap of looking at the alternative narratives and you get the same result. Like people are talking about prepping because, you know, we know that the stock market's been going down. And a couple of people have said to me, well, I think things are going to kick off in the autumn. You know, we're going to have food shortages. We're going to have other shortages of other resources. But of course, people were saying this. That would happen 2, 3, 4 months after the COVID thing got going in 2020.
Yeah.
And I talked about prepping with people that I know, and I never really did anything. Of course, we know that Richard D. Hall did his video on the prepping of his house,
which
I think was very useful. Mm. Don't get me wrong, I think there's certain elements of prepping to make yourself more self-sufficient are great.
Yes.
And I think what Richard did was great. But, you know, for the average person, should you prep? And if anybody asks me that question, I just say, well, I don't really know. Because from my experience, the predictions of the future mostly turn out to be wrong. And of course, they're very clear in hindsight. You know, like, for example, we can look at Event 201. I'm sure we've spoken about that before. And you've probably spoken about it with other guests, your guests and speakers. And it's all very easy to say, well, Event 201 was in October 2019, and then we had COVID in 2020. But nobody was able to say in 2019, we're going to have this global pandemic now, you know, and actually prevent it from happening. Nobody obviously did that, because it actually did happen. So, of course, things are much clearer in hindsight. You know, this is, I remember reading some prediction about somebody said that, based on a video, certain events of 9/11 would happen, and they did. So that same person then looked at another video. I think it was to do with this guy who was walking a tightrope between the towers, between the Twin Towers. There's some video about this guy. And the guy that was looking at this video said that there were certain clues, you know, as to when 9/11 would happen and what would happen. It was embedded in this tightrope walking act or something, or the guy that was doing it. I forget the exact thing. And then he did another video saying that based on that, he decoded another video using the same methods. And he was convinced that a certain event was going to unfold on the 31st of October 2018 or something. And it would be a huge terrorist attack on Chicago or something. I forget the exact prediction, but didn't happen. You know, even though this other decoding thing was like spot on, you know, very detailed. So that I suppose brings me to a topic which is kind of light when you begin to detach from the reality and to divorce yourself from negative emotions. And he came at this because he was in Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, you know, and he was actually anti both sides. Maybe that's the wrong way of describing it. He was a peacemaker, basically. He didn't necessarily agree with what the Vietnamese government were doing, and of course he didn't agree with what the Americans were doing. He just said, look, let's be peaceful about this. Let's just think about what's going on. And you know, and then he was kicked out of his own country by the Vietnamese government for not going along with their war agenda, really. Which, of course, we can imagine at the top level, this was all sorted out, you know, in these backroom meetings, you know, and to sell arms with Bell. And Bell Helicopter made a lot of money out of the Vietnam War. Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, he was probably caught in the middle of that, perhaps without realizing, at least not in the early days, that there were these globalist interests in the military-industrial complex, which were orchestrating all of this. And he was just saying in the middle of it, look, I don't want anything to do with you guys. I just want to be peaceful. And he wants to essentially end suffering. And that brings me to the idea of suffering, that this is part of studying Buddhism. You recognize that there's always going to be suffering. And, you know, one of the ways to deal with this is, A, to recognize that there's suffering going on, which is kind of obvious, you know, you kind of, you know that. But the way that he describes it, I suppose, is that you then realize that if there's a state of suffering, then there must also be a state of not suffering, else you wouldn't have a word for suffering. So he then you know, you then get into this idea of the duality of things. And he was saying, like, well, you know, I think there was some video that I watched of him where he's addressing some political groups, and he's sort of saying, well, you know, you consider yourselves a left-wing group, for example, but you do need this right wing, because if there was no right wing, you wouldn't be able to identify as left wing, you know. So it's kind of obvious stuff, you know, but I think what he's saying is you've got to accept that there is this duality between left and right, between light and dark, between suffering and non-suffering. And once you kind of accept that, then it changes your thought processes a bit, and you can kind of more, you know, you can process things differently. It shifts the way that you think about things. And I'd already sort of thought a bit about that, and some of that comes up, you know, like the yin yang symbol, where you've got that sort of, you know, maybe put that on the screen. And within that, you've got this little light circle, white circle in the black, and you've got black circle in the white. So you've got a little bit of darkness in the light and a little bit of light in the darkness, you know, and that's how things are. That's how it's always been. And it's quite symbolic of that. And so I think, to me, again, Thich Nhat Hanh doesn't talk about that symbol. But to me, what he was saying was very much related to that. So you get these concepts reoccurring. And like with what we're doing, we consider ourselves to be light workers or on the light side, where we're, you know, looking at the light side and trying to bring that light in one way or another. Whereas the mainstream media, we would say, well, they're working for the forces of darkness. Yes. They're on the dark side. Well, primarily, of course, again, I'm making sort of fairly sweeping statements.
Probably mostly they're not realising that they are, but, you know, it's exactly. Isolation again.
Exactly. So again, if they could each get into this state of divorcing themselves from their reality for a bit through meditation or whatever, and objectively observing what's going on, maybe they themselves would realise more truthfully, you know, what's actually going on. I think the processes mentally that I've been going through do have parallels with other spiritual you know, sort of practices that people go through. And I think there is a lot of value in trying to sort of meditate on these things and look at some of these meditative practices as a way of kind of handling what's going on in the world. And it, I think it can help you to function more rationally and more effectively and more dispassionately. And the other big thing which came out of the Thich Nhat Hanh videos that I'd watched, and watched many, I've only probably watched like 2, 3, 4 hours altogether, spread over several months, you know, was the idea of compassion, because he was very big on compassion and how you should be compassionate, because when somebody is acting out of fear or out of aggression or whatever, there's probably some underlying issue within them that they haven't properly identified. Mm. They haven't sat and meditated on the issue. They haven't sat and thought what's actually causing them to act that way. They've just kind of gone with whatever feeling, fear or anger, and just acted it out or used it against other people. And so that's quite useful as well, to consider that sort of situation. You know, why does one act the way that one does, particularly when it gets to negative actions, you know. And then I listened to, in fact, I was just finishing off listening to it before I came to see you guys. You may have seen this already. There was a talk by Matthias Desmet, who's a Belgian professor. He talked about the COVID situation being an example of mass formation psychosis. Did you hear about this?
Vaguely, but I'm not seeing it. But
it's quite interesting. He basically goes through that the population, it was a mass hypnosis of the population, which to trigger them into conforming or behaving in certain ways. And they go through all the details, like, you know, the masks and so forth, and people acting a certain way to, in their mind, protect their community from the COVID.
Because you see, within COVID, there's a lot of conformity action within, you know, mask wearing, the 2 meter rule, and all that.
Exactly.
I look at it, a lot of it is almost like a test, isn't it? And I see now,
I think so,
with the fuel crisis and all the, I think there's a little test there, because it's quite open now that people can see that the major corporates of these energy companies are all making huge profits.
Yes.
That's not hidden.
Exactly.
And so you've got to reconcile those things.
Yes.
And because people have so been beaten down and so mind controlled, they're not acting on it. They're not connecting it to a point where they're...
It's like they're numb, isn't it?
Yeah,
they've been numbed.
Yeah, that's the point. Yeah.
And it's almost like they're saying, right, we can get away with doing telling them, you know, right, all these companies are profits. They'll probably get mad about it, but they're not going to do anything. They're not going to come. That's not going to be enough for them to come together enough to
write on the streets and stuff. Yeah.
And this is sometimes you can get a bit exasperated with that, but then I think, right, if you're putting that exasperation in, are you just adding then this negative energy to it? So I try and pull back from that, because I feel that
good. Yeah, go on. I'm glad you said that. Go on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I feel that with the controllers, is they need us to manifest all this crap. They have to do it through us.
That's exactly kind of what I was saying.
What resonated with me when you were talking like that, and because this is something that I've been thinking of quite a while, you know. So it's just resisting that and gaining your mind back from their control.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of people, this is the hypnosis I think the people under, is it's, you know, all this, you know, mind control, this perception, you know, it's...
Yes.
A lot of people think it's their own, but it's not.
Yes.
And it's just, for me, it's just gaining back your mind back, you know, and being able to get back in control of your own mind, because otherwise you're going to give it to them.
Yes,
and once you give it to them,
you give you power.
Yeah, it's getting
power back.
Yeah,
so that's exactly what I was saying, really. And you know, this idea of manifesting what they want rather than something else which you've come up with from your own research and
I think they're not bothered if we get mad about it.
No, they're not. That's what they want.
Yes, so because that just fuels.
That
keeps on a low vibration.
Yeah, what I was glad they discussed in this Matthias Desmet video. Which was at the end, is how the people who are trying to expose the COVID narrative as being fraudulent, which it is, of course, they also can get caught up in their own thing, whereby, for example, they'll call people that follow the COVID narrative sheep.
Yes.
You know, and I've really tried to avoid doing that myself.
Yeah.
And I've tried not to do that. I probably have, you know, implied that from certain things that I've posted. I know I've posted a few memes on my COVID pandemic investigation website, and in fact goes on to check the evidence as well. And I'm sure I've posted some of these memes which are kind of making fun of some of the people that have, or the aspects of following the narrative. I know I have.
Yeah.
But I've tried to resist that because as
I think we'll be guilty of that, haven't we?
We have to
kind of hold our hands up.
Absolutely. You know, because of course we've been exposed to a lot of stuff over the years which has kind of protected us from the COVID narrative, really, although that's a word that I like, well, I don't like to use it, but it seems sort of appropriate. So, but the point is, and what they said in that Matthias Desmet, and this ties in with the Thich Nhat Hanh teaching to Saint is compassion. Yeah, you've got to say, look, they were doing the best that they could based on the information that they thought was true, you know. And it's a bit like, again, going back to the environmental human movement, saying all humans are bad, you know, we need to do this, that, and the other. It's evil to do all these things.
I agree, yeah.
But the point is that it's not that. It's people are essentially ignorant. They're not enlightened. They don't know that they've been manipulated into this, you know, false narrative that fossil fuels have to be used. We need internal combustion engines to run our economy and so forth. So there's got to be this increase in compassion all around, both for people that have come from the mainstream perspective, you know, yeah, they're just doing a job. You know, we don't like it. We don't like what they've done. You know, and I've said myself, these people should go to prison, and I think they should, you know, really, the MPs and the police chiefs. I've said this before, said it on an interview recently. You know, and that's my way of expressing my kind of, unhappiness the way these people have behaved, and the fact that they haven't at some point stopped and gone and examined the evidence and gone into this contemplative or meditative state about it and thought, hang on a minute, am I being taken for a ride with this? And instead they decided to try and maintain this hard exterior, maintain their job, you know, maintain the status quo. They haven't gone along with you know, the truth, basically. And that's one of the things which I think is very, very difficult to reconcile this idea of knowing the truth, communicating the truth to people, but also at the same time being compassionate. You know, because I get quite upset when people tell lies after I've told them what the truth is, you know, and I've written about this in my books. And you can end up quite exasperated by this. So one of the challenges then is to remain compassionate to these people and try and see if they do have a reason, you know, why they've chosen to support deception rather than expose it and challenge it. And I still have a hard time with that. You know, maybe I shouldn't name names, but I think one of the if you want to edit this bit out, you're welcome to do so. But one of the big disappointments to me was Neil Sanders.
Yeah, and, we'll probably share that, and that's
going to
go on coming
up. So, as I say, if you want to edit this about, it's fine, something and stuff.
I mean, but respect to him. And everything.
Exactly, you know, we'll give him his respect. You know, he came and did talks in 2012 in Derby for me, away talkers. It was excellent. And I think he provided an accessible set of information about the mind control and about propaganda and Edward Bernays. I think he was a person that I learned about Edward Bernays and all that, you know, the propaganda techniques which were developed in the 40s or the 50s. And then, of course, he gets into all the mind control stuff in the CIA and all of that, you know. Very, very useful stuff, very accessible. I read both his books, you know, and the books are called Your Thoughts Are Not Your Own, which you more or less said, I think, you know, 10, 15 minutes ago you were saying that, you know. Yeah. And I thought that was a really good title.
I've read them both resonated.
Exactly. Me too. And he was kind enough to give me the books. But Neil Sanders has been on Facebook and on his blog supporting the pretty much the standard COVID narrative, that it's a real virus which is a threat to people, etc. I don't know about the finer details. And he also seems to support the standard narrative about climate change to a large extent. And I've asked him if he'll read my book, you know, about climate change, where I lay out all the evidence that, you know, this is just a scam.
Yeah.
It's another fear-based control narrative like COVID, just with a different spin on it. You know, it's been much longer term. Some of its scope is bigger than COVID. Some of it is perhaps narrower to some degree. But it's all part and parcel of the same thing. Neil Sanders has never acknowledged that. He just continues to support the narrative. So in those sorts of cases, you think, what the hell's happened here then? You know, because this guy should be awake to all of this, yet he appears to be following the standard, you know, narrative of things. And there's probably more than one example of that, and some of those that you and I have spoken about. So at the same time as going through some of these thought processes, I'm still kind of aghast at you know, folks like him and some of the arguments that I see, you know, over these things. And I will push the boat out a little bit, but then I'll just walk away. You know, I'm not, I don't want to get into conflict with Neil Sanders or anyone else for that matter. But by the same token, I can't, when he's making such statements, I will challenge him the same way that I'll challenge him for anyone from the mainstream media and ask him to justify his stance based on evidence. And also ask him why he's not willing to examine the evidence that I've put before him. When, you know, fair is fair kind of thing, tit for tat, I've examined the evidence that he's put before me for the topics that he's written about and being interested in. You know, on a friendly one-to-one basis, you know. That's the way I look at it as well. So, you know, there's been a bit of that I think has tends to weigh you down on these occasions. So we can sort of take a sideways step with this, because there's a couple of threads which come to mind following on from what we've just been talking about. And the first is, you know, the various narratives are put forward by various groups within society, if you will. And I was recently given to write, fairly recently given to write, which I called Should We Trust the Science? And I think it was that was the subtitle, but Worlds Apart, Should We Trust the Science? And so, you know, if we have a lack of compassion for the mainstream media and the people that are acting in it or from it, and we have a lack of compassion for the people in academia, could that result in us throwing out the idea of science being useful in our lives? And this has been another quite serious issue in my view of things. For example, we've talked about the flat Earth stuff before. And this came to mind because I had a chap that contacted me quite recently. Now, he first contacted me way back in 2004. He was interested in Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, as was I. When I got listed on that website, he found my email address, he contacted me, we were talking about UFO stuff. And over the years, so that's like, you know, 17, 18 years ago since I first spoke to this guy. He'd been to my house once, chatted to him on the phone quite a lot. And he sent me some good links. He was the guy that sent me Pet Goat 2, that Pet Goat 2 video, which is very, very weird. And it's a video which apparently shows...
You mentioned this before.
Yeah, I might have brought it up. It's about 10, 15 minutes, and it's like a CGI video of some psychedelic boat trip, and it's got a Jesus figure in it, and then it's apparently got something going on in the background which looks like the Twin Towers turning to dust, and some reference to George Bush and 9/11 and stuff. And it's one of these that appears to have predictive programming elements within it. And I watched this and thought, wow, you know, that's pretty, you know, that is just pretty mind-blowing, that. Pet Goat 2, it's called, I think it's on YouTube. It's all very subliminal, very kind of abstract, you know. And he sent me that, and I thought, well, yeah, so he's, you know, he's really thinking about stuff, you know, because I hadn't thought about that. You know, it's good observations he's made on this one, you know. And he sent me various things like that over the years, you know. And then more recently he's starting to move towards the flat Earth stuff. And he's starting to move towards this Tartaria stuff, right, the Tartarian Empire. Which is something that's been put in front of me a little bit. And just very briefly, that Tartarian Empire, I think there's a lot of disinformation in there, somehow connected to the flat Earth. I'm not quite sure how, but I think the Tartarian Empire stuff that's come out is kind of like a cover, a distraction from looking at the real ancient civilization stuff, like Lemuria, Atlantis, the work of people like Randall Carlson, Graham Hancock, and others, studying the civilization which went before. And again, that factors, I think, into, we've talked about WEF, we've talked about, you know, the Bilderbergs, all of that. Another factor is, are there people that have survived or are bloodlines that have survived this very ancient civilization, 100,000 years or older, you know, that have survived into modern humanity that are, again, dictating a lot of what's going on. And again, I think there is something to that.
Yes.
Too hard to get into now, but I think there's something to that.
I think they certainly, whoever's running the world, they know a lot more than we do about the way human psychology and the way things are.
The history of the solar system.
Yeah, everything, yeah.
I think they know a lot more about that. The true history of the Earth.
Yes, there's definitely some deep understanding of that they use to their advantage.
Exactly. Yeah. And so anyway, this guy wrote to me and he says, have you looked into this jet fuel hoax? Mm. And I thought, well, kind of, yeah. This idea that jets don't actually use fuel, you know, they're actually using some free energy device and there's no fuel on them, you know, for real. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but there are videos. If you put jet fuel hoax onto YouTube, you have these quite apparently sophisticated videos showing, you know, that these jets don't have any fuel, they can't have any fuel, blah, 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 you know. And they'll convince you that this is the case. And he asked me if I'd ever heard of this, and I said, well, yeah, but it's just nonsense, you know. And then he started having a go at me saying, well, why is it nonsense, you know? And I pointed out to them that, look, you know, you just couldn't get away with such a hoax. You know, there'd be too many people involved on the ground on a daily basis, you know. I know we've said similar things about Apollo, but that's different because that was only that involved a couple of specific sites in the world.
And that's it, yeah.
It was a certain group of people, i.e. NASA, and it only went on for a set time period between mid-60s and mid-70s, 72 it finished. There are all kinds of differences that you can't just say, well, if you believe that the Apollo was fake, why don't you believe the jet fuel hoax? You know, that was this kind of logic, you know, and other people have tried to challenge with similar logic. And it's quite complicated to get around and convey to them what we've just covered in summary And, you know, when you've got these jets being refueled by ground crews, you're like, you know, thousands of hours are spent doing this at multiple sites across the world.
Are they saying that commercial jets?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's even specified whether it's commercial or real, but, you know, and tried to point out some of these things, and he says, well, you need to watch this video. So I said, well, look, send me the video then, and I'll point out where it's wrong, you know, and because I hadn't studied the actual video. Fair's fair. He said, look, if you studied the video, only a bit of it, you know, he said, well, you know, but he never even bothered to send me the video. Bothered to send me the video, which I was a bit disappointed about. But that led me on to think, well, and I get this a few times, particularly with the flat Earth people.
Yeah.
Well, they'll say, oh, you don't believe Apollo, Andrew. You know, you don't believe 9/11. So why don't you believe that they can lie about the shape of the Earth? And my answer is, well, I wasn't there on 9/11. I wasn't there at any of the Apollo launches. I don't know any of the astronauts. But I can observe for myself that the Earth is not flat. And here's how you do it.
And this is the thing. It's quite simple, isn't it, really?
You need a bike.
Yeah.
A couple of sticks. And some basic algebra, the ability to use a ruler, and some time and energy and patience. That's all you need. So you don't need NASA, you don't need YouTube, you don't need, well, you might need some websites to teach you how to do algebra. So is algebra a hoax? You know, is algebra fake?
Yeah.
And this is what I tried to convey to this guy, that he's approaching me, you know, to ask for my opinion. I'm showing him or explaining to him in brief, not in absolute, you know, meticulous detail, why something must be a hoax, you know, and that this is a psychological operation. And he won't accept it for some reason. He don't just say, oh, I can see what you mean, Andrew. He still wants to challenge me on it. And a lot of people now, you know, said, well, we've seen that what damage science can do with COVID, you know, the vaccine injuries that have come about and so forth, and many other examples, not just that. We could cite, you know, examples for the rest of the decade where science has produced bad things. But my point in trying to explain to him and to others is that I'm in a bit of a different position to him. I've been through university, you know. I learned how to program a computer. I learned how to solve problems. I learned how to do algebra. And in this article I wrote called Worlds Apart, I cite a bit of my professional experience, which is whereby we were developing this robot controller for a garment assembly project where robots could actually stitch garments together. And to do that, you had like some quite sophisticated motor controls, because the robots have motors in them and they need to be controlled in a particular way, and it uses a method of proportional placental control. Now the way that works is you need to understand algebra, you need to understand calculus, and you need to be able to make measurements. And those are all skills that you either do at school or university, and some people, you know, can manage it and some people can't. Fair enough, it's not meant to be a judgment either way on those people, But I was one of the people that could.
Yeah.
You know? And I was able, when I was given this job to do, I had to write some software for this robot controller so that, you know, it would do a certain thing in a certain time. I was given this job. I was given an equation which was used, defined how this robot controller worked, and I had to implement that equation in software. So I did that, generated some data, and then when I ran it, the behavior was not correct. It didn't do what they wanted it to do. So I looked at this, and I made some measurements. I put some numbers down, and then I had to go back to the guy that gave me the equation and say, look, sorry, this don't work. I don't know why it doesn't work, but it don't work, you know. And I showed him why, and I showed him the data, went through it with him, and he said, oh, okay, leave it with me. And then I think the next day or the day after, he came back and he had a modified equation. It was only one term removed, or one term had an extra coefficient or something. And I fixed that, put that into my software, and it all worked. And that's an example of me being able to solve a new problem. Yeah. I'd never seen that problem before. Because of my previous study, I was able to understand that problem. I didn't understand it exactly. I've never studied control theory. I'd never studied proportional political control. But because I knew what integration was and how it worked in mathematics, I could understand what it was meant to do. And I knew that when I ran it, it wasn't doing things properly. So I was able to identify the problem well enough, go back, you know. And that sort of thing is going on all the time, you know. And if it wasn't, you wouldn't be watching this video, you know, because you watching this video relies on a massive amount of technology. It relies on, for example, baseband modulation, for example. People probably won't know what that is. It relies on things like multiplexing of signals down a wire. It relies on the use of fiber optics. It relies on the use of charge coupled devices. It relies on the use of geometric optics, which is how the lenses and cameras are made to work and made small, so that you can have zoom features and, you know, an image can be focused onto a sensor. It requires the knowledge of semiconductor technology and how electrons transfer across a junction between germanium and silicon. You know, all of this I know bits about because I've studied it either at university or in my job, and I understand how, you know, the basis of it all works, you know, because that was formed part of my job. But other people don't understand this, right? And maybe they can't understand it, which is fine. But the point I'm trying to make is, because you can't understand something doesn't mean that it's not true or that somebody is lying to you.
Yes.
All it means is you can't understand it, right? And it doesn't mean that all the people who can understand it are dishonest. Yes, maybe quite a few of them are. But so I'm in this position where I know stuff. I'm not an academic. I'm not a professional scientist, but I know stuff, and I know stuff that works. And
professional background,
right?
Applied.
And I've worked in engineering. That's the thing. That's where the engineering is different to science. You can spout off in science, you know, and you can spout off and say all these kinds of things about scientific theories, you know, theoretical physics and stuff. But engineering is where the rubber hits the road. It's where science becomes real working things.
Yes,
right.
Basically, knowing how things work.
It is. Knowing how things work. And not only that, but improving how things work.
Yes, yeah.
And making new stuff which works differently, using less power or more efficiently, because you understand how the old process worked. And then you can see where, for example, it's inefficient, or you can employ a new technique, you know, to improve it. That's why, for example, we now have silicon chips and not discrete transistors. I mean, a transistor was about that big in 1947 when they made it. I think the first transistor was about that big. Yeah. And if you want to have a billion of transistors, right, that big, it's going to fill the whole of Derby or bigger. Yet you've probably got 4 billion transistors in that thing there in a tiny chip, you know, and the same in the cameras we're using, you know, because somebody has looked at that problem, worked out what's going on, and said, we can optimize this, you know. So my point is that, yes, science produces bad stuff. You know, it produces heat-seeking missiles that kill people and destroy property, et cetera, et cetera. But it also produces things that have assisted you and me in moving forward in, you know, gaining enlightenment into certain topics. So, again, it's the yin and the yang.
Yes, yes.
We're back to that again. You know, what I suppose frustrates me is that sometimes there seems to be a lack of appreciation of that. And people like me, you know, we get some blowback, and Richard as well, because, you know, he's, he and I, as you know, have a very similar background. We worked, you know, Richard used to work on nuclear submarines, for heaven's sake, you know. I've never worked in that sort of environment. And you can't get much more, you know, militaristic than that, can you, you know. Although, of course, they've never been used in warfare, I don't think. You know, so I wrote this article pointing out how you got lay people, and then, you know, they haven't really studied science. They just get, they're just living hand to mouth. You know, they don't really get involved with science, and they don't really care, which is fine. You know, that's not a problem. Then you have people like the academics who, you know, they go to university, and they'll gain expertise in medicine or biology or chemistry or physics or whatever, it's engineering, whatever it is. And they'll go into profession where those skills are employed, and et cetera, et cetera. But they will then, when you talk about what we would call conspiracies, or you talk about alternative narratives for COVID or something else, or 9/11, or, you know, the use of vaccines generally, when you try and engage them with that sort of a discussion, they will come up with some pretty good arguments. But, you know, at a certain point, they will just shut down and they will stop responding, when they know that you've got evidence that they can't explain, you know, and they will then, and I've experienced this, you know, people that I went to university with, they won't go beyond, they won't discuss it with me, and same with Dr. Judy Wood, her fellow academics, they just shut down. It's like the evidence doesn't exist, you know, and that's a huge problem. But then you also get people like me who know the value of academic, the academic world, academic study, developing skills in problem solving, either in maths, engineering, engineering mechanics, which is Dr. Wood studies. We know the value of that because it produces things like mobile phones or bridges that go across the River Trent, where you can be sure that when you travel across them by your car and your car on a train, they're not going to fall down because they've been engineered to stay up, you know, based on knowledge of how wind works and, you know, how metals forces travel through metal struts, you know, in a complex structure. That's all engineering and science, you know, and science. But there are other people like me who also want to look at this, the world of the paranormal, for example, UFOs, and get into all of that. So I call the world A people, all the lay people, they just don't really care about any of this. They just want to switch the TV on, you know, have the food, you know, do their job, and go to bed and wake up the next morning and
let life take them.
Yeah, let life take them. Repeat the cycle, go on holiday for 2 weeks, three weeks. That's fine. And then you have the academics who want to step up from that. They're kind of maintaining that system and helping to make it work better or more cheaply or whatever, more comfortably. But then there are people like me who have academic knowledge and skills, but we also know that in the paranormal world, like look, when you look at the UFO issue, there's hugely important information there. And some of it has been studied scientifically and evaluated scientifically. And that should be taken seriously by the academic community, and it isn't. But then we get people who start looking at this, and then they, for example, will see these YouTube videos about flat Earth or jet fuel hoax. And people like me, we know that that's total nonsense because we've studied the science behind such things, or we can study the science behind such things. Yet these World A people get really upset with people like me because we're telling them that something they believe is not true, which is what the mainstream tells them. So they're reacting to me like they react to the mainstream, you know. And that's really frustrating that they don't see the difference, you know. And they're supposedly on this path to enlightenment, and yet they're not willing to evaluate things like the flat Earth dispassionately. And just forget about it. You should put it on one side. It can be ignored. You can forget about it. It's not an issue. Yet somehow it becomes the most important issue ever, you know. And so this article, as I say, Worlds Apart, Should We Trust the Science? It was triggered by what I've just said about the flat Earth and this developing mistrust in science, particularly because of what's happened with COVID, you know. So that presents another area of conflict within our, you know, thinking communities, if you will. So that was something that I felt was worth addressing in this article. And it's about how your consciousness gets affected by various narratives. The flat earth is just another narrative. It's not true, you know, it's not true. And anybody that thinks it is true, well, if you want to believe it again, that's fine. But please, you know, don't criticize me when I show you the evidence that it isn't true and it can't be true. Because the same evidence which shows that it can't be true is the same evidence which leads you toward the fact that, for example, your mobile phone actually works and is not just a functionless piece of plastic. You know, it's all connected into the science. And I suppose that brings me back to one of the other things I wanted to mention earlier on. In one sense, the interconnectedness of things, and this is what appealed to me about
this. Before you go ahead, I just want to bring in another aspect of that. I suppose this relates to me and Paul and people like me and Paul, because, I mean, I don't know if I speak for you as well, but I won't say that I'm particularly scientific-minded. I'm certainly not engineering-minded. But with things like 9/11 and Flat Earth, I think there's an aspect of that where you don't have to be, because the evidence is that is if you evaluate it in an open, honest way, you can see quite clearly. I mean, like with, you know, it like didn't destroy the bathtub, and you know,
when, that's right.
And or the seismic activity of it doesn't account for, you know, how the towers fell apparently. You just that aspect, you can look at it and you can see quite clearly that, you know, the narrative doesn't. This is the evidence. This is, you know, and it's a lot of people can't, I suppose, block their mind from comparing that evidence and looking it openly and I suppose objectively from other stuff. And that's, I think, an issue as well. I think some people like with 9/11 who have the, you know, bombs in the building theory, they just simply can't get past that because they're too much invested in it, and that's it. And there's a block, and that's it.
Absolutely.
And that's, I think, an issue as well.
That's it. And I think, but you know, riding on the back of that, I've been waiting for somebody to show me why the Dr. Judy Wood research is not correct. Come up with another account of the evidence which makes more sense than the one that she has presented to us in the explanation. And I've been waiting 12 years for that, longer in fact, and nobody's done it. So, you know, how long should I wait, kind of thing, you know. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, so going back to this idea of things being interconnected, these things are interconnected. Yeah. So science and your level of consciousness and your understanding of science is just one aspect of our reality. And again, I would say that when you start looking at some of these other realities and higher dimensions and things like that in the paranormal, the scientific method is only has a certain amount of usefulness for investigating things like the paranormal, the features of UFO reports and the meaning of UFO reports. Science can be employed to an extent, but beyond that, you know, you're looking at other methods, really, intuition, and looking, for example, at metaphysics, which is what Wilbur Smith talked about in the 50s. You know, we talked about that. But where this ties in for me is with some of this Thich Nhat Hanh material. What I liked about, he talks about interbeing. I think it was his word, where he points out that we are all interconnected. You know, and we are living in interconnected systems. Yes. You know, and it's fairly obvious, really, but it's easy to forget. So, in other words, if you want to cause harm or you're angry towards somebody, then that's obviously going to impact on them, you know, because you are interconnected with them, with the object of your anger or your and so on. And the reverse is true, as in you're interconnected with the objects of your compassion, you know, that you can be compassionate about. And he also makes the argument, for example, that, and this is said by astronomers as well, actually, that we are the stuff of stars. You know, the argument is that many of the heavy elements, or certain elements, are only created during star formation. So the bits of metals, you know, you have iron in your body, your magnesium in your body, they were originally part of a star at some point, which you know, blew itself apart, you know, 100 million years ago or whatever. So you can make the same sort of argument that, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh makes about you are the air in the sky, you are the bird in the tree, you know, you're the same, you're part of the same thing, you know, and I kind of agree with that. He expresses it slightly differently to how I would, but and then of course I suppose you get into things like karma and how, you know, if you do bad things will happen to you in the future, sort of thing, you know. And so I think there is that I try to keep those sorts of things in mind. Some of it's common sense. You know, if you go and slap somebody around the head randomly, they're more likely to come and slap you around then, aren't they? You know. So, but if you just walk past them and say hello and smile, you know, they're going to probably more likely say hello and smile you back. You know. So, so it's very, very simple stuff. Some of it, and I think so. I always try and bear that in mind, that things are interconnected, and we are interconnected with each other, and we may feel resentment or anger towards people, for example, that follow the COVID narrative, because we've tried to show them so much that what it's for, what it's really for, and they just don't get it, or they don't see it, or they won't see it, or they shut us out. But again, I think, you know, the reaction that we perhaps need to consider we should be having is, well, I've tried to show you, I'm sorry that you don't understand. I feel that it's to your own detriment that you don't understand or you don't want to engage with this conversation, but if that's what you want, then, you know, then fair enough. I'll leave you with that, and I'm just going to go over here and do my own thing. I'm sorry, you know, and if you want to ask me any questions later on, I hope you will, you know, because I'd be glad to discuss it with you more, sort of thing, you know. And that applies not just to the COVID narrative, yes, but to just about anything. So, you know, you remain both compassionate to people, because they end up in situations because their circumstances are different to yours, and they end up having different experiences to you, either from birth or with their own everyday lives, with relationships, with family, with jobs, with you know, the financial situations which arise or don't arise. And so I think, to me, that has been a factor which I think has come more clearly into focus over the last 2 years. And it's something I always did consider, because I've never been one to really push hard on things. I think going back to around about 2007, I was trying to push 9/11 information out a bit more enthusiastically than I do now. I'm generally of the view now that I'm not going to do any of it except if people ask me a question. Like last year, you and you guys very kindly said, oh, there's this event going on in Birmingham, will you come and speak? You know, and we went down to Birmingham, didn't we? And that was 2020, well, it's 2 years ago. Yeah. And we had that very nice gathering there in that square in Birmingham, didn't we? Devlin was there. I think that was like August the 3rd or something. Around about then. Just over 2 years ago. So, you know, I respond to things like that. And in fact, I don't know how much longer you want to go on for, but I've got
a couple... Right, half hour or so. You're all right, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Do you want to drink or anything?
I'm all right at the minute, I think. So on that sort of theme, I generally do things by invitation rather than sort of... occasionally I'll do stuff off my own bat, so to speak. But I've got a couple of talks coming up, one of which is in Norwich, which is on the... 24th of September, and that's going to be on the energy topics, the free energy stuff. It's going to be like a
filmed, or are they just?
I don't know about that but that one's already on. That's the Infinite Energy, but not for the masses. That's the one I referred to earlier.
I've seen that one.
Yeah,
is it quite an old one? That one.
Yeah, it is. I first put that together. It's 2010. I put the original version together in 2010, and then it was redone a couple of times in 2012. And then I'm going to kind of redo it again. It won't be that much different, really, because the information hasn't really changed that much. Maybe one or two things I could add. And that's going to be in Norwich, St. Luke's Hall, on the 24th September, 7 p.m. I've put the details on checktheevidence.com. And then before that, in fact, it will be 2 weeks' time. That'll be the 24th of August, down at Syston in Leicestershire.
All right.
Just outside Leicester, it is, and I'll be doing a talk there. But it's only going to be part of a larger event. I think they're having about 10 or 20 speakers or something. There's each getting an hour, and that's going to be at the they call it Freedom Fest, I think, which is free event.
I've heard that.
I forget who's organising that. A chap called Simon that's invited me into that group. But that's I'm just going to be talking for like 45 minutes there, so it's going to be like a really cut down version for me. 45 minutes is the slot and 15 minutes question time. 15 minutes break. I'm gonna see how that goes, because events like that where I've been that before can be very dense, you know, and they tend to overrun because people want to interact and ask questions.
Yeah,
and stuff,
you can imagine.
You know?
Yeah,
and at 45 minutes on it, you know what? Like, get Mark Devlin 45 minutes on, it's not going to happen, is it? Same with me.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of, like Michael. Feeney, he'd be the same, wouldn't he? Mark Conlon, he'd never get anything done in 45 minutes, would he? Yeah, at least, I'm just kidding, of course, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. But these topics, they're not one to rush out, though, are they, really?
No, exactly.
Because there's a lot of things to connect to them that you need the bigger picture for a lot of time, you know, so yeah.
That's
right. It's
difficult
to condense them, really, I imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, on that point, this is one of the problems with the mainstream, that it's geared towards relatively short analysis of things, you know, like in a given news bulletin, even the main news bulletin, what, half an hour, 25 minutes, as I don't know what it is now, the evening news, but that might cover like 10 different stories, you know, so you might get 3 minutes on each story.
I'm wondering if, because, you know, in recent years, the general attention span of people have become less and less, and I'm thinking, does that kind of come into, you know, what we're talking about? Because you can't have a short attention span. If you want to learn this, you have to invest a bit, you know, to fully at least begin to get the fuller picture. You can't just hope that in a, you know, 5 minute, you know, soundbite, you're going to get everything, you know. And that's, I think, the mentality of a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's that sometimes puts people off as well. Yeah.
I agree. I think that's a big problem. And I think there have been, efforts or apparent efforts to get young people more into this fractious sort of state of mind. Things like TikTok videos and YouTube shorts even now.
Yes.
They've become a thing, haven't they, in the last sort of 6 months. I've noticed that those popping up. I mean, in fact, I was trying to find something the other day on YouTube, and all I could get was a YouTube short video, when I knew that there were other videos on there which I wanted to find. I'd watched them before, but I kept getting presented with the YouTube short. I'm like, no, I don't want that, you know, and that, but that was what the search engine was putting in front of me, you know. I know Instagram, of course, with Instagram posts, and people are encouraged to make these short clip videos, and Twitter, of course, that tends to be fairly short posts, doesn't it? I think there's definitely, and then again, even in our everyday lives, our own attention can be divided up, can't it? You know, with WhatsApp messages. I've been using WhatsApp for messaging people. So those ping up, and then I flip my phone open, I look at the WhatsApp message, open the email, and then, there's a new email. What's that? Oh, it's from such and such. Oh, how is it getting on? Then somebody will pop up a message on Facebook. So I flip to Facebook, you know, from my daughter or something, you know, or somebody's looked at my picture that I've put on and somebody's liked it, or we're going to see who that is.
Or me and Paul saying, you come out for talk.
Yeah. And that's the worst one, really. So, you know, your attention does get divided.
It does. It does.
And so I think, again, that kind of goes, circles back a little bit to the meditation start side stuff, where, and this is something I've been doing more regularly recently, not every day, maybe once or twice a week, is actually doing a meditation on something where you're just sitting for 15 minutes and listening and not necessarily thinking particularly about any given subject than the meditation. So that's kind of a almost an antidote to this division of your attention, you know, in some ways. And some of these meditations can be like half an hour, 50 minutes, half an hour. And you think, oh, am I just wasting my time? You know, I should really be doing this or that, you know. But actually, it's like when you take a rest and you have a break, you think, well, when I go on holiday or something, I'm going to really fall behind on something. You know, if you get in a job where emails stack up or jobs that you need to do stack up because you're getting calls to go and do gardens or something. But actually, when you get back, you can work more efficiently because you've had a break, you know, and you can, your batteries are recharged, so you can tackle more in a given period. So, you know, that I think is true as well, that if you do try and focus on things, you know, and not get your attention divided, etc., or you do have a complete break, don't worry about falling behind with things, just have a total break, you know, do just reflect on the last few days, last day or something, or do a meditation, you know, and there's plenty of them on YouTube, that can actually then help you to become more centered and more focused on whatever it is that you feel is a problem in your life, and actually work around that in some way, or come to terms with it. Even if you can't work around it, then it can help you come to terms with it more, which then may give you insights into how to move forward, you know, into a new situation without creating any more conflict or unhappiness, really, you know. So I think that, to me, is the value that you can get from such practices.
Yes.
And I suppose I was aware of that, but based on recent experience, I think that's become a bit more clear to me based on conversations that I've had and stuff. So yeah, anybody that wants to follow that up, I think it's probably worthwhile, you know. And I suppose, really, just thinking about the consciousness aspects, again, perhaps I can finish up with a little discussion, because I think last time, or the time before last, we spoke about this Wingmakers material, this supposed group of aliens, or they're either aliens or they're meant to be humanity from the future, which had travelled back and laid down this time capsule in South America. And I've done a bit more study into that material now, and it's no less interesting than it was when I last spoke with you and read out a bit of that glossary. And I also posted a couple of videos about it. In fact, I've made a series of five videos. They're about 10, 15, 20 minutes each. And going through this glossary of Wingmakers material. So I think one of the things we spoke about last time was they seem to predict the creation of YouTube.
Really?
Where they basically talked about this, I always forget the acronym, it's called Olin. And they basically talk about a system whereby people can interact with it as a form of entertainment or education, and it will tailor its what it presents based on their, you know, on their searches and on their keywords. And there was a danger that this would then only present a certain selected set of information to that person, thereby sort of limiting what they were exposed to. And this is, we've now got a word for this, it's called a filter bubble or an expression, which is what YouTube does. It tends to present things that you've, you know, similar things to what you've liked, you know, what you've clicked on. So there was that. And then also the other thing that came up in reading one of the interviews, there's an interview with somebody called Dr. Neruda Anderson. And this is all from, if you read the Wingmakers material, it's meant all to be fictitious, you know. But he talks about the coming digital network in the world, which was big, and this was made in 1998.
That screen, man. You want to fancy that screen?
No, I think not.
It's right past the door there.
You can pass now.
Yeah. And so, so he talked about this coming sort of digital global network. And he also talked in 1998 about a global digital currency, which really surprised me. And the way that it's described, how, you know, the large sort of banking networks all had plans for this, you know, back then, or before back then.
This was
1998.
And then this was set as fiction, apparently.
Well, you don't quite know the way they describe it. They don't say whether it's, they sort of say, well, is this fiction or is it myth or what is it, you know? So it was a very interesting comment. In fact, maybe I can try and find it. It's a short piece that I posted. I'll see if I can find it on. Now, mind you, I'd need to log on, wouldn't I? But have I got it on here?
Let's do a bit of research on Wingmakers and do a talk on
that. I remember that last time. I remember doing a little bit of editing. I remember maybe some kind of attachment to it, I think.
Yeah.
I remember exactly.
I'll see if I can find the... that's no good, I don't think. So, I want to... is it on that? You can obviously edit this out as needs be. If I go to there and then I go on to box.
I think is as well, do you know about, like, you know, how we can manifest our own things as well? There's also, from going back to the near-death experience that I had, I remember seeing, like, lanes I can go, I can go. Because I saw myself in different ways. In my future, which obviously I was 14, I didn't know where I was, and I didn't know what it was too much of what I had. But when I got to like 30s, then I realised in like, oh yeah, this is what I saw. And I just saw things like phones in my hand.
Oh wow.
I saw things like that. But then also I saw like possible death. That when I was like 30s, I could have, gone a different road. And I decided from that memory, it's saying like, do you remember that what you saw in your near-death experience? It's going off in my head. It's a conversation.
Is this when you're like really down? Is that, right?
And then especially that, and they're saying like, yeah, you're heading that way, mate. So either you change it. And so another death I saw was actually me in, well, I think it's me again, but older and in looking like a place like Russia. In a flat, I could see like the window, the bed, one woman there, cabinet, and all this kind of thing. I was thinking like, so what's that as well, you know? And I'm thinking that now, obviously, married a Russian, before Russian lady, you know, it's that kind of stuff. So
it was apparent that it was Russia in your.
It looked like a Russia because I had a lot of connections with Russia in the near death experience.
Wow.
But so yeah, so I think we can manifest a lot of stuff. Mm. But also roads are also booked in for us a little bit.
Well, I think that we've already lived this life because I'm a great believer of like past, present, future, it all happens.
All in one go,
and because of the vibration, it's slowed down and so time is now separate the way we're experiencing it.
So
I think...
I agree with that.
So I think you're probably right.
I think we've probably had this like so many goes of these things, but maybe in different ways, different formats or...
Yeah, we can include this chat on the thing.
Have this on here. This thing about the wingmakers who were talking about this. What I think are accurate predictions from 1998. Mm. I think this might have even been recorded a year or two earlier. And I posted this on Facebook not too long ago, about a couple of months ago. And it was an alleged interview with this scientist called Dr. Neruda Anderson, who worked in this secret subgroup of the NSA called the Labyrinth Group. And they were tasked with decoding this Wingmaker's time capsule material, which was on an optical disc. And they do give a few details of how that was decoded. It's not extremely detailed, which it does lead me to believe that it might be authentic. But again, I can't say hand on heart, this is really true. But this was written in 1988. Dr. Anderson says, there are many organizations that have noble exteriors and secret interiors. I mean... that's perfect, as far as I can find out. I've actually written something very similar to that in one of my books. In other words, they may have external agendas that they promote to their employees, members, and the media, but it is also a secret and well-hidden agenda that only the inner core of the organisation is aware of. The outer rings, or protective membership, as they're sometimes referred to, are simply window dressing to cover up the real agenda of the organisation. I mean, I'm sure you've felt that from what you've read.
Yeah.
And here we go. The IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, Foreign Relations Committee, which I think is the Council on Foreign Relations. It may have been renamed since 1998, I'm not sure. NSA, KGB, CIA, World Bank and the Federal Reserve are all examples of these organisational structures, which again is what we've come to conclude, I think. Their inner core is knitted together to form an elitist secret society with its own culture, economy and communication system. These are the powerful and wealthy who have joined forces in order to manipulate world political, economic and social systems to facilitate their own agenda. The agenda, as I know it, is primarily concerned with control of the world economy and its vital resources, oil, gold, gas reserves, platinum, diamonds. Mm. This secret network has used and utilised technology from the ACIO, which is the Advanced Contact Intelligence Organization, which is basically back-engineered alien stuff, for the purpose of securing control of the world economy. They're well into the process of designing an integrated world economy based on a digital equivalent of paper currency. This was 1998. This infrastructure is in place, but it is taking more time than expected to implement because of the resistance of competitive forces who don't understand the exact nature of this secret network, but intuitively sense its existence. The only organisation that I'm aware of that is entirely independent as to its agenda And therefore, the most powerful alpha organisation is the Labyrinth Group, which is this group that claims Dr. Rudyard Anderson works for. And they're in this position because of their pure state technologies and the intellect of its members. All other organisations, whether part of this secret network of organisation or not, or powerful multinational corporations, are not in control of the execution of their agenda. They are essentially locked in a competitive battle. And that's, you know, again, supposedly from something which is meant to be fiction. But I'd say that, you know, he's written, what, 200 words there or something, 300 words? That pretty much sums up a lot of the sorts of, you know, conclusions that we've drawn from all this stuff that we've looked at.
Things that are coming through in this world or come through in this world.
Wow. So, you know, when I read that, I mentioned that in one of the videos. So again, you know, if you haven't looked at the Wingmakers material, I've got an article on that on Check the Evidence. And I'm going to be trying to write a bit more about this in this book on consciousness that I'm trying. I haven't really made much progress with this since we last talked. I think I did mention it. But there's been a few topics, some of which we've mentioned today, which I'm going to try and include. My objective with that book is to kind of like bring in a whole load of stuff, like in conversations with people, you know, they'll talk about Buddhism, they'll talk about Hinduism, maybe they'll talk about the secret, law of attraction. But I like to throw in, well, how are aliens involved in this? And how do they factor into all of this? You know, I've heard about psychedelic experiences by taking ayahuasca or various potions. Yeah. But then again, some people report experiences like alien abductions, according to Rick Strassman's research. Yeah. So how does this all tie together? So I want people to be able to pick up this book that might know a bit about Buddhism or a bit about Hinduism or a bit about UFOs to be able to pick up the book and learn about other topics. Like if they know about UFOs, they might learn more about Hinduism or Wingmakers or, you know, the basis of the Gnostic Gospels, for example. I've come across a little bit of that. Gnostic Gospels, which I didn't know were I didn't know they were called that, actually. I knew of these Nag Hammadi texts because John Lash talked about that.
Yeah.
But I either forgotten or didn't know that.
I think David Iders as well a bit, don't you?
I think so, yeah.
John Lash mainly.
So I want to put all that together, you know, into kind of something so that people can come to that and say, oh, yeah, I've heard of that. We've never heard of that before. You know, again, to widen out the discussion, broaden out the picture, because it's all part of the same thing.
Yes.
It's all part of this enlightened view of the cosmos, really, not just, you know, what's happening in the last 20 years, but the whole of human history, you know, and all of that.
This is the thing I like about your book. You bring almost everything else together, like, you know, connected together. Mm. So you can see everything is connected. Everything is part of that, part of that, you know. And I think your books do really good for that. So I'm looking forward to this book. Have you just started writing it then? Is it just early stages?
Yeah, I mean, it's still the early stages, really. I mean, I've sort of got the structure of it, more or less. But the stuff I want to, I've got to flesh it all out, you know.
Yeah, so you've not got no idea of when you're going to
book. No, I mean, I'm hoping, you know, I might get something ready towards the end of this year, maybe, if I'm lucky. But I've got a few weeks now where I've not got much work on, so I'm going to try and, you know, move forward with it a bit more. And so we'll see how that goes.
That'd be good. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll definitely, if you want, we can invite you back when the
book once I've got it, I can go through the main chapters and stuff, no problem. Great. You know, and it will, I'll do it the same as I've done the other ones. It'll be a free download once I've done it on PDF.
Yes.
And then, you know, if people want paperbacks, they can just, they'll get them essentially from Amazon or from, you know, my website. Just, I'll make a few quid on the paperbacks, but the download will be free.
Right, brilliant. Well, it's been another fascinating talk, Andrew. We've gone to a lot of different subjects, but they all tie in.
Exactly.
It's really good, really good. Thank you for coming along, Andrew, and first, I suppose, comeback, I suppose.
Comeback video.
Yeah, a bit of a break. But it's great to be back, and it's great to have you as our first guest in this, I suppose, the second phase, I suppose, in that planet. Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you,
and good luck with your ongoing projects and things that you told me about. And again, I much appreciate you taking the time today and putting it all together. Very much appreciated.
Always a pleasure. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye bye.